Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. It's time to learn and improve your American English skills and hear about interesting developments from around the world. We come to you 7 days each week, and we always present our stories in ways that are easy to understand if you are learning English. We speak a little bit slower than normal and use words that are easy to understand. Today we have a special program for you. It concerns American leaders in two important areas. A new study confirms what most people already know. American women are still far behind American men in taking top leadership jobs in business and politics. The Pew Research Center in Washington, D.C. produced the study. Ann Ball tells us about the findings.
Pew researchers found that most Americans believe women have the right qualities to be leaders, but they say women may still not be hired into leadership positions.
On the one hand, the public thinks that women are just as qualified as men to be in top leadership positions in business and in government. On the other hand, the public feels that it's easier for men to get those jobs. And the public is also skeptical that things are going to change in the future, particularly on the business front.
Kim Parker directs social trends at the Pew Research Center. She says the new study found that Americans think men and women have the same intelligence and ability to create new things. But Americans think women and men have some different abilities. For instance, they believe women are especially good at finding compromises. In other words, women can find ways for people to agree or at least accept solutions. The study also found Americans see women as more compassionate and organized leaders than men. Americans also believe women are better leaders for social issues, such as education and health care. But Americans see men as better leaders on national defense and security. In the business world, Americans say women still have challenges at the top. Sally Krawcheck would know. She held top jobs at leading financial companies such as Smith Barney and Merrill Lynch Wealth Management.
I never saw overt gender discrimination when I was at these companies. When I was at Bank of America and Citi, which own Merrill and Smith Barney, but I certainly did see a lot of individuals making choices about promotions or people to move ahead or new projects to give, in which the recipients were people who look a lot like themselves.
In 2008, the financial company Citigroup dismissed Ms. Krawcheck from her top-level job. Ms. Krawcheck says that for years she had said she was not fired because she was a woman. Now, she says maybe that is possible. Because, she explains, she wanted to solve a problem in a different way than the rest of the other leaders, all of whom were men. In time, the other leaders accepted her plan, but the company later dismissed her. Ms. Krawcheck says women often have different approaches than men, and they have different strengths. As a result, she says, teams that include a variety of people are better.
The power of diversity, diversity of all kinds, diversity of gender, of color, of thought, of perspective, that those are additive, and the diverse teams are actually so powerful that they outperform more intelligent teams.
Sally Krawcheck now heads two companies. One company, called Elevate, connects women with each other and supports their professional and financial success. She says her company is an important part of a bigger trend. People around the world, she says, are talking about how important female leaders are.
We are having an absolutely amazing global conversation about the positive impact of the economic and financial engagement of women.
In another study, the Pew Research Center compared the number of women in the U.S. legislature to the number of women in similar positions in other developed nations. The study found the U.S. was in the lower half. Drew DeSilver is a senior writer for Pew.
We stand at about at almost exactly 20% of the membership of the House and Senate are women. And that would put the United States in about 29th place out of 49 countries studied, tied with the Czech Republic and Saudi Arabia.
Even getting to that 20% of the Congress has taken a long time, Mr. DeSilver says.
It's taken almost a century for the United States to go from one woman, from the very first woman in Congress, to having 20%. Of women in Congress, and that most of the increase has taken place in the last 20 years.
When it comes to women in high-level presidential cabinet jobs, America has done better. Now, close to one-third of President Obama's advisors in his cabinet are women. That percentage places the United States at 13 among the 49 countries studied. But of course, America has yet to elect a woman president. In contrast, women have served as president or prime minister in countries from Great Britain to Brazil, from Israel to India, and Ireland to Argentina. Researcher Drew DeSilver says in some parts of the world, such as in Scandinavia, political parties are required to nominate an equal number of women and men. Therefore, women and men can hold an equal number of seats in the parliament. Such requirements can help women reach more cabinet-level positions as well. The U.S. has no similar requirements for political parties, but even so, Pew researchers found most Americans think they will see a woman president in their lifetimes. Some observers say that person might be Hillary Clinton. While it is difficult to predict the future, Professor Larry Sabato from the University of Virginia Center for Politics said in January he thinks Hillary Clinton will run for president with the Democratic Party.
She's a heavy, heavy favorite to be the Democratic nominee. She hasn't formally announced. Some people think she might not run. That would be an enormous shock. I think she will run. She will be the nominee.
With or without a woman president, an increasing number of women in the U.S. are already serving in their state legislatures. And researcher Kim Parker says that across the country, more women than men hold managerial and professional jobs. In time, those women may also rise to the top in politics and business. I'm Ann Ball.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Now that you have heard Anne's story, it's time for you to print the words using your computer and save the audio as a podcast. That way you can go back and read it again
and practice speaking American English. You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America. Let's get together again tomorrow.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. Taiwan's annual university admissions tests are taking place this week. Tens of thousands of students are trying to give the right answers to math and language questions. High scores permit students to enter the top schools. However, these tests will not be in place for much longer. The current examinations require that students memorize facts in high school classes. They do not test critical thinking or creative problem-solving abilities. Officials in Taiwan plan to change the admissions test to also measure imagination and the ability to innovate. Taiwanese officials see the progress China and South Korea are making in the information technology field. By comparison, Taiwan is losing technology business. There is concern that younger people are afraid of the risk of starting a company or inventing something. The Ministry of Education wants to encourage young Taiwanese to innovate. So it will begin a new selection process for university students. They hope the best schools will start to accept people with new business ideas. The new admissions policy will take effect in 2018. It will include personal interviews with interested students. The ministry wants high school graduates to show they excelled outside of class. Ma Xiangping is the ministry's deputy director for higher education. She told VOA, "The new exam system will look for people interested in invention or starting businesses." She said Taiwan will lose competitiveness if all the inventing is done in other countries. She said the ministry hopes new admissions policies will reshape the 12-year public education system. She said it should not focus only on memorization of facts, but also on the growth of other skills. Ms. Ma said that the written admissions test should be used only to show that a student has basic knowledge. Chang Wei-chun is a third-year law student at Ming Chuan University in Taipei. The student said Taiwan's educational reforms should carry into higher education. Chang Wei-chun said that officials should promote innovation in classes at universities. The student said many students will not risk doing inventive work because their university education remains traditional. Taiwan is dependent largely on high-tech exports. The Swiss Business School, International Institute for Management Development, IMD, made a list of the most competitive countries in 2014. Taiwan was at number 13, but Singapore was number 3, and Hong Kong was number 4. These numbers worry Taiwanese officials. About 300,000 students graduate each year from the almost 150 universities in Taiwan. The results of this year's exams will decide the admissions of 146,000 people. Many are seeking admission to the 10 highest-rated schools. I'm Jill Robbins.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Abraham Lincoln did not live to see the final surrender of the armies of the Confederacy. A Confederate sympathizer shot the president at Ford's Theater in Washington on April 14, 1865. By that time, however, the American Civil War really was over. General Robert E. Lee surrendered in early April, bringing an end to 4 years of fighting. Several other Confederate armies were still in the field, but they were too small and too weak to continue the fight. This week in our series, Morris Joyce and Leo Scully tell the story of the final surrender of the Confederate armies.
One army was in North Carolina, commanded by General Joe Johnston. 5 days after Lee's surrender, Johnston asked for a meeting with General William Sherman, the commander of Union forces in North Carolina. Sherman met with Johnston a few days later. He offered him the same surrender terms that General Lee had accepted. He said the Confederates must give up their weapons and promise to fight no more. Then they would be free to return to their homes. Johnston said he could not accept these terms. Johnston said he had the power to surrender all the Confederate armies everywhere in the South. He said he would do so if Sherman agreed on a political settlement.
The two generals met again the next day. Sherman listened as Johnston explained his demands. Most of them Sherman accepted. He believed that President Lincoln wanted to help the South as much as possible. He had heard Lincoln say that he wanted to make it easy for the Southern states to return to the Union. When the agreement was completed, Sherman sent it immediately to Washington for approval by the new president, Andrew Johnson. The agreement seemed to give the South everything it wanted.
Instead of surrendering to Sherman, the Confederate armies would break up. The soldiers would return to their homes, taking their weapons with them. They would sign a promise not to fight again and to obey state and federal laws. In exchange for this, Sherman said the president would recognize state governments in the South, which promised to support the Constitution. He said federal courts would be established in the South again. And he said the president, as well as he could, would protect the political rights promised to all people by the Constitution of the United States and the state constitutions. And Sherman said the United States government would not interfere with any of the Southern people if they remained peaceful and obeyed the laws.
President Johnson held a cabinet meeting to discuss the agreement Sherman had signed. War Secretary Stanton and the other members of the cabinet were violently opposed to it. They said Sherman had no power to make any kind of political settlement. President Johnson rejected the agreement. He said Johnston's army must surrender within 48 hours or be destroyed. He said the surrender terms could be no better than those given General Lee.
Johnston decided to surrender. On April 26th, his army laid down its weapons. One by one, the remaining armies surrendered. The soldiers, began returning home. Many of them were bitter. They wanted to continue to fight. They spoke of guerrilla war against the Yankees. But most of the Confederate commanders opposed this. Many, like Cavalry General Nathan Bedford Forrest, urged their men to accept defeat. Said Forrest, in a farewell speech to his men, "It is a clear fact that we are beaten. We would be foolish to try to fight further. The government which we tried to establish is at an end. Civil war, such as you have just passed through, naturally causes feelings of bitterness and hatred. We must put these feelings aside. Whatever your responsibilities may be, meet them like men. You have been good soldiers. You can be good citizens."
Confederate President Jefferson Davis fled south after the fall of his government. He hoped to get across the Mississippi River. He believed that he could form a new Confederate army. If this failed, he planned to escape to Mexico. President Lincoln had hoped that Davis would escape. He felt that punishing Davis would only create more bitterness and make Reconstruction, the rebuilding of the South, more difficult. But President Johnson did not share Lincoln's feelings. He believed Davis had a part in the plot to kill Lincoln. He said, "Davis must be captured." On May 10th, Union forces found the Confederate president's camp in southern Georgia. They seized him and took him to Fort Monroe, Virginia. He remained there for many months under close guard. His trial was never held. And finally, in 1867, he was freed.
Late in May, 150,000 Union soldiers, representing every one of the Union armies, came to Washington. They came to take part in a big parade, a victory march through the city. For 2 days, the soldiers marched past the White House. Many of the marching men had fought at Bull Run, at Fredericksburg, Antietam, Gettysburg, Petersburg, and Appomattox. Sherman's Western Army was there from battles at Shiloh, Vicksburg, Murfreesboro, Chickamauga, and Atlanta. The soldiers marched proudly past the president and other government leaders.
All along the way, from the Capitol building to the White House, were huge crowds of cheering people. Hour after hour, the soldiers passed. Never had the city seen such a celebration. Each group of soldiers had its band and carried its own battle flags. Some proudly carried flags that had been torn in fierce fighting. Finally, late on the second day, the final group of soldiers passed the White House. The grand parade was over. The battle flags were put away, and the marching bands fell silent. The war was ended. Now, men could look about them and count the cost of the war.
4 years of bloody fighting had saved the Union of States. The Northern victory had settled for all time the question of whether states could leave the Union. And it had put to rest the great problem of slavery. which had troubled the nation for so many years. But the costs were great. More than 600,000 men of the North and South lost their lives. Hundreds of thousands more were wounded. Many had lost their arms or legs.
The war cost the North almost $3,500,000,000. It was almost as costly to the Confederates. Most of the war was fought in the southern states, and most of the war damage was there. Hundreds of cities and towns suffered damage. Some, like Atlanta, were completely destroyed by Union forces. The damage outside the populated areas was almost as great. Union armies had marched across the South, leaving behind them widespread destruction. Farmhouses and buildings had been burned, animals and crops seized or destroyed.
Transport in the South was especially hard hit. Union soldiers had destroyed most of the railroads. The few Confederate trains that escaped capture were worn out from heavy use. Riverboats had been destroyed, and roads and bridges were in terrible condition. The South had no money to rebuild. Businessmen and rich landowners had put their money in Confederate bonds, now completely worthless. Confederate war debts would never be paid. There was also the question of the 4 million former slaves. They were free now, but few could take care of themselves. They needed jobs and training.
The people of the South faced a difficult future. They had been defeated in battle. Their economy was destroyed. In many areas, there was little food, and the people were hungry. Farmers could not plant crops because they had no seed and no animals to break the ground. There was no money for rebuilding. To add to all these problems, radical Republicans in Washington were demanding severe punishment for the South. Instead of offering aid, they demanded that the government sell the of Southerners to pay Union war debts.
President Andrew Johnson, himself a Southerner from Tennessee, opposed the radical plans. He had his own program of reconstruction for the South.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Morris Joyce and Leo Scully. Transcripts, podcasts, and historical images from our series are at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also comment on our programs. And we invite you to follow us on Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English. Thank you.